Hello, friends. Welcome back to Recess, the unfiltered podcast for aspiring entrepreneurs. Today, we have Tomas Luda. He started Valet Closet, which is revolutionizing the storage space industry and only making people pay for what they use. And then on the side, he also used to run a limestone mining business and a gold mine, which will be interesting to dive into. And then on top of that, we also learned he was a professional table tennis player and actually helped start one of the largest organizations for that in Austin here. So a lot to explore. Good to have you here today.
Yeah, nice to be here, guys. Thanks a lot.
So how did you get into Valet Closet? Talk about the story there.
Yeah, so I've been involved in the self-storage business for about 10 years as an investor, as a developer and operator and stuff like that. And during a period of time, I started to realize that people don't really need all that space that they are paying for. We as investors were making an enormous amount of money, but everybody else felt cheated, right? Paying for a 10 by 20 and you're using just a little portion of it. So as I was driving by one of our properties, I realized that, hey, I can come up with a solution where people pay only for the space they consume. And that's how the idea of Valet Closet came about, is fractionalizing physical storage space, basically.
Gotcha. So what are the economics of something like that?
Yeah. So, you know, calculating the cost is quite a challenge and a fun at the same time. So we came up with some algorithms on, okay, we know how much the space costs, right? We have an on-demand pickup and delivery with our service as well. That is a huge variable because sometimes the driver can take 10 minutes to execute something. Sometimes they take 20, right? So coming up with some educated assumptions and calculating the cost associated with that, all that is done on the back end. That's all algorithm. That's all software. And it's in an instant. So we calculate all the cost, storage, pickup, deliveries, and quote a price with the customer with our profit margin.
And how's this compare to a regular self-storage?
Yeah, so as the average price around Texas is about 90 cents a square foot. That's what you would, as a user or as a customer, pay in the self-storage industry. Ours, and I should add, the average price per month is about $110 a month. Okay, with us, you're paying much higher on the square footage price, but much lower monthly bill. So we are making much higher profit margin than the self-storage industry does. But for the users, they can cut the cost by up to 40%. So your bill would be $60 a month, for example, but we would be making about $4 to $6 a square foot.
So basically, income. You take your same self-storage space that you would use for someone else instead of splitting up into a bunch of different units where everyone gets their own specific unit, right. And then they maybe put like a little bit of stuff in there, and there's a bunch of wasted airspace that they could have been using, but they don't use because they didn't need that big of a size.
Yes.
Exactly. So how does it work? Do you have a big warehouse that you pick and pack from there, basically, or how does that work?
Yeah, we use actually existing storage facilities. So we don't have anything on our own. We don't have trucks. We don't have employees. We don't have assets, essentially. We are just pure software play. And we use existing storage facilities or warehouses or commercial buildings.
So you would rent out spots inside a self-storage building.
Correct.
And then you would basically arbitrage pay people, or people would pay you more per square foot, but you would pack it much more efficiently. Than a regular storage facility would.
Yep.
Got it. Yep. So how did you come up with this idea exactly? It's very niche.
Six beers. No, I'm not kidding. It occurred to me that this should exist. And then I drove to Dallas to one of my friends and bought about six pack. And we came up with just on a piece of paper with the algorithm on calculating the fractionalization.
Wow. So how long have you been doing this for?
About 3 years at this point.
Okay. Yeah. And where are you at today with Valet Closet?
So we are in Austin. We just launched. The way we are launching is a storage as an amenity in multifamily industry. So we launched into a couple of properties in Austin as a pilot version 2, if you want to call it. And right now we have about 400 properties that are interested in our product and launching.
Wow.
So Austin for now, Dallas next, Houston next, and then we'll take from there.
So where do these 400 kind of leads find out about you from?
Actually, we went to one trade show and it was cute because we had a small little booth, and probably the smallest there because we are cheap. And but we had the biggest crowd because our amenity is so not just unique, but the value proposition is incredibly strong. Right, storage is needed basically for anyone. So there's no solution that exists in the multifamily at this moment.
Interesting.
So you said you used to invest into just regular self-storage like any other person would.
Yeah.
Tell me how you got into that.
Through table tennis.
Really?
one of the good guys that I played with, he is a huge developer in the self-storage, and we started playing more and more, starting talking about the investment side of things, and that's how I got involved about 20 years ago.
So were you a passive investor or were you...
Passive first, obviously, just to learn the ropes and try to understand economics. And then I got more involved on the development and operation side.
Yeah. Okay, so where'd you get the money to invest into self-storage? Was that from your gold mine?
No, it wasn't from there. I'm not attached to money, like your savings and stuff like that. I've always been raised with the mind of invest as much as you can, and that's where it kind of all started. I started with a small 10 grand investment and then grew it from there.
What have been some of the biggest challenges running Valley Closet?
The messaging to the users, messaging to potential clients, because as soon as you say the word storage, people have an idea in their mind what it is, right? It's dirty. It's, the storage units, you're dealing with some old lady and it smokes 10 cigarettes a day, right? Or an hour, whatever, right? So that message, changing that message into a positive experience is quite challenging.
Interesting. So how do you go about tackling that?
So I'm not a marketer, nor am I an engineer. I'm just coming up with ideas and I hire people that are much smarter than me. So I'm looking now actually for a marketing agency, or not necessarily agency, but a partner that could help us reframe that messaging.
Wow. So you don't do the marketing or the tech side. You kind of just...
I did that website. If you looked at that, that's my work.
It's a beautiful site.
I don't think so. That's about the extent of it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So coming out of college, where would you do right out of college?
Well, I actually started Limestone Quarry, or I got involved in that during college. I dropped out and I finished college about 3 years later.
Okay.
So I've been involved in business, during college and right after that.
So I'm sure everyone's wondering, that's not usual for a college student to just get into a limestone quarry. That's pretty fascinating. So talk about the story there.
Yeah, that actually is quite interesting. So it was 2008, and you guys are young, so I'm not sure if you know how much you know about 2008, but nobody had any money. And I was always interested in startups and doing something. So I had a nice little business plan, and I was looking for investors, but nobody was giving any money at that time. And during that period of time, something interesting started happening in the limestone quarry business. There was a generation change. You had parents that were trying to get these mines to their kids. The kids didn't want anything to do with it. And I started seeing more and more of them popped up for sale. And I thought to myself, okay, there is a business that's operating, has minerals in the ground, has some assets in equipment, and has a book of business, right? So that should be pretty much easier to raise money for, and turns out it was. So we raised about $3 million really quickly, actually, and acquired a limestone quarry.
Wow.
So what are the economics of a
limestone
quarry?
Yeah, I was going to ask as well.
So that was exciting, actually, because it was a commodity business at the time that I entered, and it was quite challenging to get the pricing up. The costs were as low as they could be. The prices were set by the market, so the margins were negligible, almost non-existent. It was pretty pathetic, actually. And so I went around and started to realize I was probably one of the youngest operators in the country at the time. I was in my early 20s, so everybody looked really down on me, right? I mean, this is an old industry. But I started to realize that I can make some changes in how stuff is mined, because I'm technical in, grew up around computers, stuff like that, right? So I started playing with lots of the math and developed some product strategies that are a little bit different than what existed at the time, and we were able to raise the prices. Not only that, but also ensure, and I think this was the kind of what really set us apart, ensure that somebody said, hey, I need this by Friday. My stuff was there by Friday. That was unheard of in an entire industry at the time. But I was called all kinds of things during that period of time. Yeah.
So looking back now, it's like, oh, yeah, this was a business that's changing generations, and so I can get into it easy.
Yeah.
It sounds simple, but how do you actually figure out that limestone quarries are changing generations? How do you see where all these for sale at? And
there was a website back then called Biz Buy Sell. I think it's still alive.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where they all started popping up. And I think, once you start seeing more than one, you start seeing two, three, four, five, then something is happening in the entire industry, right? That's where the opportunity starts coming up.
Wow.
Now, I'm not saying if you see 10 nail salons, something is happening in the nail salon industry. That's different, right? You're looking for a business that is a business, not something that a franchise or something that you can start with just 100K, right? You're looking for some value.
So was this first of all, this was in Europe, right?
Here in the US.
Where in
like 60 miles north of here.
Got it. So was this a family business or where did you get the initial investment?
At the time, it was a family business. I got it from investors here in Austin. But at the time, it was a family business. It had like 9-10 employees or something like that.
So as a college student, how did you convince investors to give you a big fat check to go do mining, which is something you had no experience with?
I didn't convince them. It was the assets, right? The assets were undervalued. Again, this was a business that kids didn't want. So it was very easy to come up with some valuation of the assets and negotiate a price based on that.
And so the investors weren't like, oh, you're too young to be doing this, or you have no experience?
Well, there were several of those objections, right? But I'm good looking, so I'm convincing.
So then how'd you kind of go about learning the whole industry?
That was an experience. We lost an enormous amount of money the first year. We probably lost 90% of our customers in the first year as well. That was existing at the time. But at the same time, that was also on purpose. I was trying to raise the price so we can make some of that money, right? So, I was called a communist and all kinds of things in a period of time by all kinds of people. But in the end, we got, you know, better customers, started making some real profit margins and stuff like that. Took about 3 years to get it, to get the education and make the changes.
Who are the main buyers of a limestone?
Yeah. Of limestone itself?
Yeah.
All the general contractors that you can think of, especially here in the south, everything is made out of limestone. Up north as well, like northwest, everything is made out of limestone. So there's a lot. Yeah.
Interesting. So if you're saying it's a commodity and like the price is basically set, right? You're not controlling that. How do these customers figure out which of these limestone quarries to actually buy from? Is it just whichever's closest?
Or is the cheapest? Because there is still that going on, right? Hey, people are willing to take a hit on the price to be able to be on that that building, for example. So yeah, that still exists.
And then so
it was a nasty industry.
So where did gold come into this?
So during a period of time, I started having a lot of experience in the mining industry and starting to get some recognition in terms of, okay, he knows what he's talking about. So I was approached for consulting first on a gold mine that was in Alaska. It was a complete disaster. I don't know how much I can say. But anyways, so I was approached on consulting first. And then I was approached on, okay, let's raise money for this. My expertise in mining and my kind of credibility in mining helped raise lots of money for that gold mine.
It's very interesting. I don't think I've ever met a mining expert.
So no.
if someone wanted to get into that today, is it still a good time, bad time? What would they need
good
to know?
Good time, bad time. Well, so the mining heavily relies on what's happening in the construction industry, right? And geography, I always mispronounce that. My wife makes fun of me all the time. also matters where you're at. Here in Texas, everything is made out of limestone. So it's very easy to do that. Now, is it easy to get into the industry? No. During that period of time, there's probably 1,000 operators in the country. We all know each other, right? So when a new one comes on, it's very easy to kind of gang up on them and try to get them out of business as quickly as possible, right? So it is not an easy industry to get into, that's for sure.
How did that work? How were people ganging up and getting the new player
just
out of business?
More competition created in a commodity industry, unfortunately, just more supply, which drove the prices down. So you didn't want that happening very much, right? So you knew who the new operator was on. There was a lot of backstabbing in that industry during that period of time. It was not much fun.
So what are some of the things you learned from that whole experience? You said it was like a hard industry.
I learned how to manage about 150 people. That's what I learned. And I also learned I don't want to have 150 employees ever again. that was one of the things. And I also learned, you know, hey, fire as quickly as you can. People are either good for your business or they are damaging your business, right? Mm-hmm. If anybody is damaging your business, every single day you let them be there, they just create more and more damage, right? So that's was probably the biggest lesson. There was
so in your other early 20s, how do you go about firing these people?
Oh, yeah, that was fun, right? Yeah, how do you do it? You drink before you before you go there and then you fire them. This is an at-will state, so it's a little bit easier to do that, right? And
yeah.
Interesting. What are some of the other lessons that you'd learned from that?
So lots of the things that I've learned from that industry, there was a logistics component of it, which we have in Valet Closet now as well. So I ran about 6 trucks in intrastate and whatnot. So that was also lots of learning going on there. And then obviously operations, accounting, and all that good stuff.
So how long did you do this for?
About 7 years. We sold to a private equity in the end.
Okay. What was the decision of wanting to sell and not continue?
It was just, so there was another kind of a change happening during a period of time when there was lots of consolidation in the limestone quarry business is happening. So there was several groups that started buying many, many operators and putting them under one brand. So that kind of drove that decision. I was approached to create a huge conglomerate in Texas and Oklahoma of limestone quarries during that period of time, but I denied that because I wanted to move on to other projects.
Interesting. So, yeah. So what advice would you have for someone who's now maybe either in college, just graduated, has a little bit of cash on hand, and they want to go to buybizsell.com and buy an asset? How would you figure out what are the best assets to invest in now and what are things to keep in mind?
That's interesting. So obviously it depends how much you have at that disposal, right? One of the things that you can kind of need to keep all your mind open to is there's many businesses where the seller will finance portion of the sale, right? Those are the ones that I think are very, very attractive because the original owner is vested in you to make this a success, right? So don't buy a restaurant, don't buy a nail salon, like I said before, right? Buy something that's an established business, for example, in this scenario on that website, where the owner is willing to stay on for a year to train you, right, to carry some of the debt of purchasing this business. And you can get that done with 100K, 50K. I mean, it's very simple. I say simple.
So you raised $3 million for your first acquisition of this limestone quarry. How much of that was your own money?
None.
None. So you had 0%, $0 in the deal, basically.
I was made responsible for it, right? Okay. So I had a lot on the line, right?
And did you take debt on as well as equity?
To purchase it?
Yes.
Small portion, yes. Small portion that was taken on by the original owners.
Yeah. And then 7 years later, what was the kind of economics of that acquisition from a private equity company?
So I can't comment on the price. But it was nice. it was nice. That's about it.
So yeah. So you made a good chunk.
Yeah,
of money.
I made some, and investors made some. And
good.
Yeah.
So where did you get this confidence from in college to just take on $3 million to go invest into an industry that you'd never known anything about?
So it's my entire family has been involved in business in one way or another. And, you know, you mentioned earlier competing in table tennis. You start taking risks, right, at a very, very young age. I started playing when I was like 5. So you start taking risks and become very risk averse. So that's where that confidence comes from. Is if it's a loss, it's a loss. If it's a win, it's a win.
So did you know, like, at the back of your mind, like, oh, this will definitely work out? Or was it more of like a, yeah?
Oh, yeah, 1,000%. Yeah, I had a full confidence I can make it work.
Wow. Was that blind optimism? Or?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I was naive. I mean, up to that point, I never fired anybody, right? And then all of a sudden, you're like, well, shit, there's somebody that's been doing this for 30 years, and I have to fire him, right? Mm. How do you do that?
Interesting.
Right. So, yeah.
Kind of that being naive kind of gets you started, right?
It does.
You probably would. If you knew everything that you know now after starting when you were in your early 20s, would you still have started?
I would do it, but I would do it very differently. I mean, it would be experience you can replace, right? I can tell everybody, that starts a business or gets into entrepreneurship, you know, what not to do. But everybody thinks they know better, right? It's not going to apply to me. That advice, that mistake you've made is not going to apply to me. Everybody is that way.
So what would you do differently?
I would fire people way earlier than I would have. That would be number one thing. And I would also probably got rid of some product that was existing, some product lines that were existing.
So in an industry like that, what are people doing wrong so often that you need to fire them?
It's not doing wrong. It's just that it's when I was doing it or when I was involved in it, it was lots of buddy business, right? You know, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. Well, in real world where you're trying to make profit margins, have some returns, that doesn't really work because all of a sudden you start making side deals, you know, deals behind everybody's back, and you know, it stops being about profit margin, starts being about favors, right? So that was kind of frustrating.
So when you exit this business, what's next? Where do you take that chunk of money? What do you do after that?
After Valet Closet or after
after the mine?
After the mine. So I did another one in there, which I don't talk about very often, but it was when virtual reality was coming up. You might have experienced playing virtual reality in warehouses. Have you seen that? In like Vegas has it, some of the strip malls where you can have a computer on your as your backpack and you run around and have a VR glasses and whatnot, right? So that didn't exist at the time, but I saw a company in Australia that developed that entire business model, and I reached out to them and tried to brought it into the US. And we did, which was actually lots of fun to try to get off the ground, but we got pushed out by Dave and Buster's. I'm still mad about it.
Explain that a little bit. What do you mean?
So what I mean by that is because they developed the technology, we had to license it, right? And literally an hour before we signed, Dave and Buster's swooped in and said, hey, instead of these guys, we're going to put in all of Dave and Buster's in the US. And that was obviously a bigger carrot than what I could offer at the time. But one achievement from that is we raised $1 million in about an hour.
Oh, wow.
that was fun. One presentation.
Wow. How did that happen? Was that like a cold email from you to they reached out? Or?
You know, back in that day, in those times, you would have investors. What we did was we would put out lunches, or we would make investors come to us in one room, right? So I would have, for example, you would get a country club, get a bunch of investors together, and you would make your pitch. You paid for a nice meal. Everybody likes to show up to a nice meal and stuff like that, right? So that's was much easier to raise funds than what's happening today in my mind.
Interesting. So on your LinkedIn, in the in-between time between Valet Closet and when you were doing the mining stuff, there was Neobium LLC.
Yeah, yeah.
Explain that a little bit, because you did that for 10 years.
Yeah, that's my consulting in terms of helping startups. I help lots of startups, invest in startups as well. And any consulting, basically. That's where my assets actually lie.
Got it. So this was right after the whole mining business. You're like, okay, now I want to take what I learned from here and go help other kinds of startups.
Yeah.
And so what do you mostly help them with?
Actually, believe it or not, most founders don't realize they are not solving any real problems, right? And that's kind of a first wake-up call they have when they talk with me is, hey, your stuff doesn't really need to exist because the problem is already being solved and you're not proposing anything different. You're just solving it in a different way, but it's not enough for the user to make the switch in their, you know, in habits, for example.
So how do you suggest someone would find something that's actually an issue to solve in order to
How to find? Just go to your own experiences, right? If something is very frustrating for you, this is where innovation comes from, right? I'm very, very frustrated. I get frustrated with like Google Calendar and all these calendars. I mean, I have 6 different email accounts. Try to keep up with all the different calendars. It's freaking impossible. And nobody has really come up with a solution right now that I see that works really, really well. So that's frustrating for me. How can I change that? Another one is, you know, I'm in a fundraising mode for Valet Closet right now, and I'm incredibly frustrated with the venture capital, that entire ecosystem and how it works. So my next venture is I'm going to fix that damn thing. Right. How can we make it more efficient?
Some of the problems you've seen in that VC ecosystem?
They're slow as hell. Again, it's a generation change that's going to happen there, right, pretty quickly, or it's already happening. So by the time they start making decisions, I have moved on. I have tested the product with 100 more clients, right? I have made improvements 1, 2, and 3. The valuation I told you 2, 3 months ago no longer applies. I have proved it more, right? They take too much time to get back to startups.
Interesting. So what do you want to do to solve that? Or don't want to say that in public?
No, I'm happy to talk about it. It's just that, you know, the way you have to think about this is VCs get bombarded by startups. I talked earlier about also, the startups don't need to exist, right? So that's the first step that needs to happen is how do we make all the startups that don't need to exist disappear so the VCs get introduced only to the ones that solve real problems, right? Not the hype, not the Web3, not the crypto, not the VR, right? Whatever we don't know, what is it now? The AI that's kind of cooling already. So how do we get rid of all of that noise and introduce to some business models that where 1 + 1 = 2, right? Kind of a thing.
Interesting. So you mentioned one of the biggest problems you saw during that whole consulting phase was founders creating products that didn't actually solve a real problem, right? Yep. What are some of the other most common problems that you would see that these startups are falling into?
This is a problem that's been talked about many, many times. Don't build a product before you talk to your users. It's so hard to get in founders' heads that you don't need to have a perfect website. You don't have to have a perfect product. Actually, one of my friends here in Austin, before he launches a product, he talks to 1,000 people in coffee shops. That's his kind of go-to. Is I'm going to talk to 1,000 people. I'm going to ask them if this is something that they would need, that it solves some different problem, you know, a problem for them, before he does anything, website, product, anything of any sorts.
So I'm sure you've met a lot of different people through table tennis, through your different business ventures, through your different investing, through all the startups that you've met. Out of all those people, if you could pick just one of them and you could say, I'll invest into them, only one of them, and you get 10% of all their future earnings, who would it be that you invest in, and why would it be that person?
Yeah, I'll say it because the ladies will appreciate it. There's a company called Obsesh. I forgot now where they are from, which Washington State or probably they're now going to be mad at me. Those two ladies that started that are brilliant, brilliant marketers, and they were in their later, you know, I can't say the age here, but they were older than me. And but when you look in their eyes, when you talk to these founders, there are some that you can just see that they are going to make it. Right, you can feel it. You can feel that passion. You can feel the conviction. This needs to exist. This problem is a real problem that I just need to find a way of talking to my users so they see what I see. And Obsesh has been brilliant in that.
So what is the problem that they're solving?
Oh, you have to look it up. They are doing, like, when I was involved with them on the advising side, they were doing short clips from professional sports people and you know, getting kind of the behind the scenes. Hey, this is how I practice before a game. Kind of showing, you know, what's really happening behind the scenes of somebody being a professional athlete. One another. They probably expanded to other things at this point.
Interesting. What are some of the other like biggest characteristics you look for in people who are just building cool things and you're like, I need to be a part of this because of who you are?
Well, that's a good question. It's, I don't really care what is it that you're doing right now. It's the question, or what I'm looking for is, do I want to be part of something you are doing at some point in your life? All right. There are people that I have on my radar. I'm like, okay, this next venture, I want you and you and you to be part of my team. I don't care what you're doing at that period of time, right? I want your characteristics and I want your mentality to be.
So what are some of those characteristics and mentality?
So I'm looking for a different point of view, right? I have a way of looking at the world and looking at things, right? I'm looking for an opinion that's different from mine. What is it that I'm not seeing? Can you challenge me? Can we sit on this whiteboard that's behind you guys and for an hour, and can we come up with some opposing views to what I think should happen? Right. So those are the things that I'm looking for a lot.
So you mentioned earlier that you're not a big saver. You don't save a bunch of money. You like to invest as much as you can. So kind of where are those investments if you had like a pie chart of how you invest?
Oh, yeah. That's a good question. I have kids now. So lots of the money is sitting in, you know, those safe mutual funds and stuff like that. Otherwise, I would say 60% would be sitting in startups.
Okay. And so you're an angel investor in those startups?
Yes, yes.
How many checks do you write, like me, per
year? Not now many, many, because I have this to focus on. Before this, I would say 3, 4, 5 a year or something like that. Yeah.
Interesting. So why angel investing? It's a relatively riskier space to be in, right?
It's riskier to be in, but you get there early, right? 9 out of 10 startups don't work. Right. So you try to find the ones that do. Obviously, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I find that early start is incredibly exciting. I say to all my startups when I mentor them, I know about myself. I'm an amazing entrepreneur. I'm a terrible CEO. Right. There's something that happens when the CEO role needs to happen or needs to come in, when you have the legal department, when you have the HR department. Right. The mindset switches. So I'm good up to that building point. Then I'm looking for an exit in another period of time.
So you're good at going from like 0 to 1. And then from there, you need some sort of operator to come in and deal with like the bigger kind of issues that come up.
I could do the vision, right? But, you know, I tell my people all the time, the best ideas I come up with is when I sleep or when I drive for a very long period of time. So if I drive to Houston 2.5 hours from here or 3 hours from here, right? I come up with amazing ideas, what we should do. I want to be able to get into the office and say, hey, managers, come over here. We're going to try something over the next day and a half, right? Once you get to a certain level, you can no longer do that because there's a manager to a manager, right? There's production schedules, there is certain plan, strategic plan that's being executed. You can no longer go and say, hey, stop what you're doing. Let's try a new test, right?
And so how do you want to exit at that point? Is it taking an operator and hiring someone to
do
that?
Either hiring,
just to own the interest, or do you want to do an exit?
Either hiring or exit. Yeah, hiring or exit. Yeah.
Interesting. What have been some of your favorite parts of working on that consulting business?
Just being exposed to so many different... I did international startups, so being able to expose to different cultures. One of the things that you see starts being very, very common is people come up with ideas at the same time around the world. It's crazy. Like, you think you have something unique? There's somebody in Japan or China or Singapore. They're working on the same exact thing. It's unbelievable. And you start making those sort of connections and you start to realize that, okay, the opportunity is not just here. The opportunity is literally everywhere. And people are just genius, incredible what they come up with.
So when it comes to Valet Closet, you mentioned that you do angel investing. Did you take outside capital for Valet Closet?
We did for a little bit. We are raising now. It's a very difficult time to raise at this stage. I don't know how much you guys know, but it's brutal. Hopefully it's going to open up in the next month or so. But we took a little bit, yeah.
How do you think about raising
capital? Yeah, right now we are still early. We are in early seed stage. So we are raising probably from angels. I'm trying to stay away from VCs for now and just raise from angels.
Interesting. Do you feel like that's going to stay a challenge for long, or hopefully not? Or?
No, I think it's going to kind of cease to be a challenge about beginning of next year.
So you mentioned one of your friends, every time he's launching a different startup, he will talk to 1,000 people in a coffee shop, right? How many people do you have now that are using the storage, and how did you kind of get validation before that?
Yeah, so the validation, you know, I talked about earlier, don't build something unless you know it's going to work, right? Test it out, right? Talk to people. So we did about 150 clients where I ran everything on an Excel spreadsheet. And that was hard, right? Excel spreadsheet can get you to a certain point, but not very much further. But what it did, it validated the math, which was very, very important. And then I spent past year and a half building the actual software that can execute that. So right now we have 2 properties. We probably have a small number, I think 20 users. We've serviced about 200 over the years, still testing and perfecting the math.
Got it. So is the plan to expand all across the states and then internationally? Yep. Or?
Definitely internationally. We have lots of interest coming from Europe. The need is literally everywhere. So yeah.
And what's the long-term goal with something like this?
So long-term goal would be, ideally, in my world, would be to change the way people perceive of movement of items. So think about this way. It's a nice day outside, right? You're hanging out with your friends, you're having a beer, and you decide that you want to go on the lake, for example. So what's happening today? You go home, you change, you get your kayak or whatever, or your, what is that? Paddleboard, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or your paddleboard from your home, and it takes you 2-3 hours before you all organize and get going, right? I want to flip that. I want that lifestyle to change. I want you to be able to go on a ramp and say, hey, I'm going to the lake here in the next 2 hours. I want my paddleboard there. I want my swimsuit there, right? And it shows up. And you no longer have to go home and waste all that time and make that.
It shows up from your house, like your own belongings, or like a rental?
No, it shows up from what you have stored with us, right? That extra closet, basically.
Oh.
Right? So you no longer have to make these, or if you go on a golf course, right? Hey, I have golf clubs at home. I have to drive home for an hour to get them, and I'll meet you guys there, right? No, go on the app, say, hey, I'm going to golf in the next 30 minutes. Bring my golf clubs.
So the idea would be that everyone would store almost all of their personal belongings with you, and then wherever they are, it could be delivered just like that.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I'm hoping to get to.
Amazon Prime level logistics system.
That's right.
And so, what's your timeline of something like that?
When do you think 2 years. Be a possibility?
2 years.
2 years.
Wow.
I'm thinking we can get the first version late next year, assuming we get funding the way that I'm expecting.
So, what needs to be done, or what would you do with that funding?
So for this, the messaging, I talked about it a little bit earlier, redefining how people think about storage. Right now, when you look into your closets in your apartments or your homes, it's or the attic, right? It's a disaster zone for lots of people. It's not organized. You don't know what you have. All right. So I need to switch all that mentality and say, hey, keep whatever the heck you want in your closet, but what you use on sporadic basis, put it in that extra closet, that virtual closet that I'm introducing here, right? And live with that not only do I want you to take in and out, I want you to use it. I don't want you to store it and forget it. That's what the storage industry does. I want you to use it as much as you can, because the more movement of items there is, the cheaper everything becomes. Right? So that's how I look at that.
Got it.
The messaging.
That's very interesting. So now, how would you say you spend your time, like, overall? Because you have, you're still working on the consulting business. You have angel investments. You're working on Valley Closet, right? And then you have kids, life at home. How do you balance all of these different activities?
Ask my wife. So one of the things that, you know, my wife comes from a corporate world. So she's very much around being able to have a schedule. I'm more around the line. Along the lines of, I'm feeling right now that I want to go to the pool with the kids, so we'll go to the pool with the kids, right? But I wake up at 3 in the morning, and I'm like, oh my God, I just had a great idea. I'm going to turn on my computer, and I'm going to start writing it all out. So my schedule is very sporadic. She hates it. But that's the way that it is for me.
Interesting. You're what you were talking about earlier reminds me a little bit of Jack Ma, the founder of Alibaba. Yeah. He had this one quote where he's like, I don't know how to do anything. I don't know how to code. I don't know how to do this stuff. But what I do know is how to hire smart people and then get them to work with each other, right? You said that's kind of your idea, where you didn't do a lot of the marketing. You didn't do a lot of the tech. How do you hire for those right people?
Yeah, so that actually is, I find a lot of fun in that, right? So when I interview somebody, especially for the high-level positions, I give you my vision for the product. That's my kind of a box. That's my boundary, right? This is what I'm imagining. I'm looking for that person that can take it a step or two further, all right? Hey, oh yeah, this is great. We can also do this and this and this. It's not just, you know, adding a feature here and there, but the concept starts changing, right? So I'm like, okay, now somebody is on the same track as I am. They see the world the way I do, all right? Something needs to change. Those are very hard people to find, but once you do, I mean, you have them. The team is created all of a sudden.
That's a great way to look at it. So you don't just look for, can they do the thing that I'm assigning them to do? It's, can they see the world the same, or the future worldview that I have the same way, but then on top of that, add their own iterations and just expand on this view?
Yeah, whatever happens, happens, right? I mean, it doesn't matter whether my vision comes to reality or their vision comes to reality. The point is, we are changing the world together, right? That's what I'm after.
Interesting. Yeah, so as that kind of top guy, how do you deliver that vision to these people that you hire? Like, how do you get them all like fired up?
I just told you with that paddle board, right? That's how I think you should live your life. You should be able to get the items with a click of a button that, you know, side of a lake, right? That's how I think it should be. And what I do, kind of a trick I do when I talk to somebody, is I tell you what my vision is, and 20, 30 minutes later, I ask you to repeat it back to me. Right? Did you understand the vision? Do you get it? Can you expand on it?
And if no, then you fire quickly, right?
As you learn from the miner. Yeah, that's it, right? You might be a good worker and you are smart. That's fine. But that's not the time for me right now. I don't need you right now. I'll need you down the road, but not this very moment. I need visionaries with me. Right?
Interesting.
And smarter people.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. I think that when listening to a podcast, people do it while they're washing the dishes or mowing the lawn or in the gym or whatever, right? And it's really easy that it can go in one ear, out the other, and they can forget everything they heard, or they didn't really learn anything from it. Yep. Or they might think something, but then 2 days later, they forgot what it was. And I think the only way to actually like truly learn something is by doing. Mm-hmm. And so for you, based on all the things we've talked about, what is something that someone that listens to this podcast can actually do so that they can actually take something away from the conversation and use it in their life in order to be better?
You know, I was giving a little presentation to fourth graders the other day. And one of the things that I told them was, and I was trying to explain to them what entrepreneurship is. The word, they don't even know what it means, right? These are fourth graders. So I had to come up with a analogy of what an entrepreneur does, and we came up with, hey, let's develop flying cars, right? Flying cars are super exciting, right? But let's develop flying cars together here as a class. And you kind of walk them through, you know, making a business plan, hiring people and everything, fundraising and whatnot. But one of the things I told them, and what I tell people all the time, is don't get stuck with your kind of what you go, the motions of life that we all have, right? When I drive, when I walk somewhere and I see a business or I see a restaurant or anybody doing anything really, and it was cleaning the streets, I'm trying to think about the economics of it, right? What does it take to execute this? Because it's not just getting a cart and a broom, right? There has to be some sort of strategy to cleaning a street, right? So think about what problems does this solve that I'm looking at right now, and how did it come to be? That's, I think, is the most important thing. Why does it need to exist? That's how I kind of tell people, stop right now what you're doing, look around you. That Apple laptop that I have right here in front of me, right? I mean, the marketing was just brilliant, right? And you started replaying in your mind what you saw, what convinced you to buy it. I would ask you, you know, what convinced you to buy that Apple laptop versus any other laptop, right? There was something that did that.
Interesting.
Right? The same with cars. I have this idea of interviewing 1,000 people. Why did you buy this particular car? I don't care what it is. I don't care money. I want to hear that reasoning, right? Because you bought a PT Cruiser. That's a shitty car. Why did you buy that, right? There was something was happening in the port of life that drove you to that decision, and I'm interested to know what it was.
Interesting. So kind of reflecting on the own purchasing decisions that you make in your own life and thinking, why did I buy this? What did that company do right in terms of their marketing, and then reflecting
back. Yeah, digging a little deeper into the things you see every day that you just take for granted, like me walking down the street, or if I see this business every day, or I go eat at McDonald's every day. It's taking a step back and thinking a little bit deeper about the things
you see. And it's cheap, right? You don't need money to do this, right? But it's that analytical mind, right? It's that thinking outside of the box. And then you start seeing opportunities. As soon as you develop that habit, you start seeing opportunities in other places. Hey, this could be done better. I can deliver this faster, more accessible, or more affordable, right? That's how you start seeing opportunities all of a sudden.
Love it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, yeah.
Seriously, it's been a pleasure, and you have a very interesting story. And good luck with everything with Valley Closet.
Thanks, guys.